You're listening to Girovagando by the Cycling Podcast. Today we are in Fossano.
Cozze ci tene cozze, cozze piscine, non spigudeci cora, non spigudeci cora. Cozze ci tene cozze, cozze piscine, non spigudeci cora, se non mangiano le femmine.
Brian, il barone, buonasera from Fossano.
Buonasera Daniel. I have to speak quite loudly here. We're in the middle of an aperitivo, and I think some of the gentlemen next to us have had more than their first drink.
They are in the middle of their aperitivo. Brian, let's clink glasses. We haven't even done that yet. I've got a non-alcoholic Crodino. You've got a slightly more alcoholic, but not much, beer. Brian, we're in Fossano. We're still in Piemonte. We're under the porticos, characteristic of this town and many towns, of course, in Italy. We're in the Centro Storico. About 500 or so meters, would you say, as the crow flies, from where stage 3 of the Giro d'Italia finished today. A strange day, a schizophrenic stage. There were a lot of mood swings in that stage.
Yeah.
I'm not going to suggest that those mood swings mirror the sort of characteristic mood swings of anyone in the... You're looking offended already. I wasn't gonna say you, Brian.
I don't really think I have any. At least not at the moment.
No,
still
not at the moment. It's still very early days in the Giro d'Italia.
Yeah.
But Brian,
kind of born with them, though, aren't you? Anyways,
Brian, how has the day been so far for you?
This is not part of the Processo della Tappa, right?
So no, it's not. It's a bit early.
Right. Okay.
We'll get to the Processo della Tappa. This
Daniel,
is the warm up.
It's been a wonderful day. You know, I woke up in what our host last night called a romantic room, and it was a 4-post bed, and I enjoyed that. We were staying at a winery, and it was a nice morning. I think we've just been very lucky today. In general, I think Lady Luck has been very kind to us. I don't know how much I should go into that.
Well,
in detail.
Let's go into that. Before the Processo della Tappa, so last night we did refer to the fact that we were having some issues with the motor vehicle, formerly known as Darwin Atapuma, our Ford.
Yeah, I had to double check if there actually was a motor under the hood of that.
Yeah,
one.
Our Ford Puma, and it was really struggling on the climbs already in this Giro d'Italia, so much so that it was a DNS. I did not start this morning in Novara. And Brian, we really need to come up with a new nickname or for the new vehicle, which is a rather larger vehicle. I was going to throw this open to the listeners. I didn't come up with one. If you remember in the episode you and I did about the 1998 Giro d'Italia, we heard from our good friend Matt White of Jayco Alula, and he was talking about, well, his experience in the 98 Giro, but he also shared an anecdote about Mario Cipollini. Mario Cipollini, in an extremely clever play on words, used to call Matt White black. How about, since our vehicle is black, we call it white?
Why not? I see some references to one of the early Tarantino films. What's it called? Reservoir Dogs.
Brian, I thought the demise of Darwin Atapuma was going to feature in the Processo alla Tappa. We've got it out of the way nice and early. So, let's proceed, shall we, to...
Il Processo alla Tappa, the post-stage inquisition.
Brian, after Darwin Atapuma had said farewell to the 2024 Giro d'Italia, we proceeded to, or we were already in, a northern Italian town known for having given birth to one of the stars of the Giro in the 1980s, Beppe Saroni. What was the name of that town? And, well, we've already established we're in Fossano. How many kilometres did the peloton travel between that town and Fossano?
So the stage 3 was from Novara to Fossano, and it was 166 kilometers.
Now, I'm rubbing my hands because I'm going to ask you a very invidious question, a difficult question to answer now. Was there a break in today's stage, Brian?
There was not just a break, there were several breaks.
Can you tell me about the breaks in forensic detail, please, Brian? Because I know while you were driving our new vehicle from Novara to Fossano, you had all sorts of sources. You were staying right across everything that was going on in the race, and you can tell us all about those breaks now.
There was an early break with Lilian Kalmijan of Intermarché setting off you know, in his instance, it was to get the mountain points. There was one category three climb. And Davide Ballerini and his intention, I don't know, is there not an English expression called shits and giggles? I couldn't really figure out what his presence there was for. Anyways, Calmejan got his points, and Ballerini, 10 kilometers later, waited and set up for the peloton. Then, Daniel, there was a strange situation which actually caused significant breakaway, because after the first intermediate sprint, a very significant group of 24 riders sailed away.
Sailed, did they?
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't tell if it was...
It had started raining at that point.
Well, it obviously started with intermediate sprint, because the, out of those 24 riders, there were a lot of sprinters, most of the favorites for the stage, and their lead out men. I think, without mentioning all 24, I think it's more relevant to say who was not there, because that actually caused a bit of a... I think for some stressful situation.
Brian, just in case we don't get to it later, just in case we forget, because we do sometimes forget to talk about things, we did have a brief conversation in the car about the wisdom of those riders, at least whether they would have been able to press on and make it to the finish and stave off the peloton is another matter. But would it have been wise to try? Some of them obviously did try with their teammates. Yeah. Some of them had a few teammates in that group.
It brings me again to the riders who weren't there, and seeing that the most significant riders were in the first group, they weren't, in my opinion, putting in any pressure on competitors for the stage win. And if you look at the GC riders, they were perfectly fine down in the chasing group. So it was almost as if, you know, if you want to do a lead out that's half the stage for an eventual sprint that I think most riders, sports directors included, believe were to finish and decide the stage, well, off you go. There was obviously a chase because some teams, with I would maybe call them secondary sprinters, weren't in that group. I'll name a few: Phil Bauhaus, Laurent Pitti, Fabio Jakobsen, Max Kanter, but also Geraint Thomas and Tadej Pogacar weren't in that group.
They weren't in the front group, were they?
Yeah.
This came later. A little bit later, there were also some GC riders cut adrift in something resembling an echelon or echelons.
Yeah. We were actually out there mixing it with the real world today, and not. It was very windy out there. And actually, in that, the front group, certain riders fell off, and then the front group, the chasing group, was split at some point. But that could have been serious, but it wasn't. It wasn't. It was windy, but it wasn't like, you know, a southern France Tour de France stage type of echelon.
The white jersey wearer holder Kian Uterbrooks was there was a moment in the race when he was cut adrift of Tadej Pogacar et al.
Yeah.
Unfortunately for him, everything came back together, didn't it, Brian?
It did.
And then what happened in the last 20 kilometers or so?
Well, then what happened? Well, in the last 20 kilometers, not much. Before that, there was an intermediate sprint won by Ben Swift, Tadej Pogacar second, and Geraint Thomas third. I believe you'll maybe hear some about that later. But the interesting thing wasn't necessarily the sprint. You know, I'm getting ahead of myself. It was actually a very interesting attack initiated by Miguel Honoré of EF Education, Easy Post, and he was followed by Tadej Pogacar, and they were joined by... So Geraint Thomas joined that trio. And that actually lit up the last part of the stage significantly. They were caught 400 meters to go. Honoré was dropped before that. And then it was a very, very close sprint. At least to me, it looked quite close between Tim Mullier and Jonathan Milan. It was close enough. That was one of our Italian colleagues sitting 20 centimeters from the finish, from the TV screen in the press room, celebrating the victory of Jonathan Milan.
Brian, what does the general classification look like this evening as a result of that stage? No, actually, first of all, tell us the top 10, because then I want to see how you pronounce the name of the gentleman in eighth place.
Of course, with pleasure, Daniel. So the stage was won by Tim Merlier, second Jonathan Milan, third Binyan Gimai, fourth Jente Biermans, fifth Tobias Lund Andresen, sixth Olaf Koy, seventh Ethan Vernon, eighth Stanislav Anikolowski.
Okay.
And the ninth, Fernando Gaviria. Don't interrupt me during the proceso, please. And 10th, Alberto Danese.
The general classification, please.
Yes.
Can you tell me if there are any changes on the general classification? Well, give us a rundown of the top five and tell me if there are any changes, please.
Yeah, so the top five as it stands after stage three. Tadej Pogacar leads with 46 seconds over Geraint Thomas. Third is Dani Martinez, 1 second down at 47 seconds. Fourth, and that's one place up from yesterday, Einar Rubio at 56, and then one down is Kian Uytebroeks in the same time at 56 seconds behind.
Yeah, Rubio and Uytebroeks actually swapped places today, I think purely only as a result of where they finished on the stage, I believe. No other significant changes, Brian. Pellizzari, actually. Pellizzari was one of the sort of revelations of yesterday's stage. He is a guy around whom there is quite a lot of excitement in Italy, particularly excitement about how he's going to fare in the mountains. He's also been in the news overnight because Ciro, our good friend Ciro of La Gazzetta dello Sport, has he's got a scoop, and he's reported that Pellizzari is bound for Bora Hansgrohe, what will become Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe. He lost 8 positions today on general classification. He lost some time in the finale, so not particularly good day for him. Brian, and the other competitions, I'll just give the current jersey holders. Uytebroeks still in the white jersey, King of the Mountains. Pogacar is now leading the King of the Mountains competition, 51 points for him. And Merlier is leading the points competition. That concludes the Processo alla Tappa. Traditionally, at the end of the Processo alla Tappa, Brian, you ask me a question. What is that question?
That question is, Daniel, what happened at the finish line? Who'd you see? Who'd you talk to?
Oh, yes, Brian. I spoke, as I did yesterday, to a Dane and a Welshman. The Welshman is the Welshman we've heard from every day so far. We'll change it up tomorrow, but he's been in the thick of the action. The Welshman is Geraint Thomas, but first we're going to hear from his breakaway companion for a very fleeting moment with Tadej Pogacar in the finale, EF Education First Easy Post, Mikel Honoré. Mikel, well, we were surprised by Pogacar attacking there. What was going through your head while coming into that climb as well?
You know, we don't have any sprint or GC guy really here, so our goal was for me to try something today. I like a punchy finish like this. Thinking back, I don't know, from 3 years ago in Agrigento. Needed maybe a little bit legs to follow today, but I'm in the end happy to at least have trying, and yeah, it's better to always try and see if you can win in some way, you know.
Give us a sense of how violent that attack was. Were you looking at your computer? Do you know how many watts you were doing, what gear you were in?
No, I wasn't really looking. I mean, when I looked at, I think around 800-900 watts for a minute or something. Yeah, it was about almost closing the eyes, gritting the teeth and going all out.
Simon Carr pulled out of the race today. Do you have any news on what was wrong with him?
I didn't know, actually. I know he had he had some knee problems, unfortunately, since Tour of the Alps. We still took the chance to take him here, hoping he recovered, because obviously he's in very good shape after winning not so long time ago. So no, I'm super sad to hear he's out.
A hard climb, but solid enough to make everyone suffer. The lead outs might be a bit tired or whatever. So when they went, that was just on instinct, just follow.
It must give you a lot of confidence that you were the only one to follow.
Yeah, I guess so. You can look at it two ways, can't you? Like, some people weren't in the position to. But yeah, at least I could. It hurt though.
You got to be a bit crazy in cycling. What did you make of that move today?
It was a good move. And as I said, the way that we raced halfway through the day, and then up there, you know, it was going to be hard for any organized chase. So it was worth a try. It was never in the plan. I wasn't even thinking it as we were going up. It was just about staying out of trouble, really. I was the wrong side of Timon's wheel, so I had to kind of back out and go. But saw him go, I just thought, I'll try and follow.
Just one, Geraint, on the bonus seconds. Obviously, Ben gave you a hand there, taking some away from Tadej. But was that expected that he would go for those?
Again, not really. It's just kind of you just race it as it comes, really, and we all knew that there was a bonus there. We didn't speak about going for it, but then obviously we were all there. I saw Tadej sort of on the right, so I shouted at Swifty just to go. I just rolled over. I didn't want to, I'm not as quick as him anyway, but I just wanted to take what I could.
The cycling podcast at the 2024 Giro d'Italia is supported by MAP, cycling apparel.
In front of me, in front of us, we've got I've got my Crodino, we've got a few stuzzichini, a few nibbles, I suppose you'd say, a bit of focaccia there, some meat. and some cheese. We've also got La Gazzetta dello Sport. Unfortunately, we don't. La Gazzetta used to be very much a sort of part of reading La Gazzetta. It was very much part of the sort of daily regime protocol on Il Giro d'Italia. Not so much anymore. However, we do have it in front of us. Here, it's obviously today's edition of La Gazzetta, referring to yesterday's stage. The headline, top of the page, Pogacar alla Pantani. We don't want to talk too much about Pantani again today. We did a lot yesterday. But Pogacar today, Brian, I was trying to think of who in the annals of professional cycling and in the annals of the Giro d'Italia did his move today most remind me of. And, well, I wasn't around. I wasn't covering cycling when the names I'm about to mention were strutting their stuff. But I think Bernard Hinault might have done something similar to what Pogacar tried today. Certainly Eddy Merckx.
Yeah. But Fausto Coppi.
We're not really sure. I didn't think Coppi was really that explosive, was he? Whereas Hinault and Merckx
were. Yeah, I think Coppi has won similar stages, yeah. Or flatter stages, yeah. But
Do you know what it reminded me of? It reminded me of the finale of the Vuelta a España stage a couple of years ago, which claimed Primoz Roglic. That's finishing to Tomares just outside Sevilla. A little rise, not significant in the road book. It didn't appear to be significant. But in the finale of stages, you get any sort of stretch of road going up for, you know, 500 meters to a kilometer, particularly with the GC riders already at the front because they don't want to fall foul of the sort of 3 kilometer rule. There always is a little bit of a danger, or from our point of view, the wonderful prospect of such a thing happening.
You know what it reminded me of? That stage down in the south of France at the Tour where Chris Froome attacked with Peter Sagan. Do you remember when I think they actually went clear, and I think Sagan or was it maybe Bodnar won the stage?
Was that not the one with Echelons in like the middle of France?
Yeah, I think so. But the finish line was after like a couple of roundabouts, and they just got a short gap, and they managed to keep it until the finish line. They weren't jumping away from a raging peloton as we saw today.
It was a scintillating finale, and Tadej Pogacar ended up giving us quite an exciting stage. A stage that, you know, when we looked at the Giro route a couple of weeks ago, particularly when we did our preview, I called this year's Giro d'Italia route a bit of a turkey. I think that was based on the sort of, the paradigm that we've seen over the last 3 or 4 years. I looked at a profile like today's, and you could sort of see in my mind's eye a Bardiani rider, not called Bardiani anymore, but Italian Pro Conti riders going off down the road, maybe 3 of them, and it being a really routine bunch sprint. It was not a routine bunch sprint at all, and I suppose today was the ultimate proof that it's the riders that make the race. And when you have a rider like Tadej Pogacar in the race, you often get a great race, and you don't really need that much in the way of sort of spicy topography.
I also have to say I'm really impressed with, you know, just before we spoke about Kian Utebrooks, and this is also a learning experience for him, but when you see the way experience and panache is combined in the persona of Geraint Thomas, it's just great to watch. Like how race smart he is, how on it he is in the final, how he's able to use his team in any type of situation. You know, he was second yesterday, today he was part of animating that final, and it just keeps impressing me also, you know, at his age, that his will to race and his nose for it is very, very accurate.
Yeah, he appears to have got his preparation right for the Giro d'Italia. As we know, I don't think it's any secret, and he said this himself over the winter, his big conclusion from the Vuelta a España last year was that he's really struggled to get into peak form, to be al dente, the phrase that I like to use nowadays, twice a year for Grand Tours. Some of the other preeminent GC riders of our day are a lot more consistent in the sense that, you know, they seem to be able to go into sort of races in any month of the year and show something like their best self. Geraint Thomas has a bit more of a kind of an old school way of, I'm not talking about the training methodology, but the fact that he has these real peaks and troughs as well.
Yeah.
In contrast to some other riders like Pogacar, for example. But he clearly is in very good form. But that was an incredibly powerful attack from Pogacar. It was an imaginative attack, I suppose you could say. There was a lot of fantasia to it, as the Italians would say.
I mean, it was initiated by Miguel Honoré, not to forget. You know, and ironically, this was the guy who crashed when in front of Pogacar in Liège-Bastogne-Liège when he broke his wrist. So they certainly knows what his rear wheel looks like. He's probably had this in his face a little bit more than a year ago. But yeah, that was, I mean, it's also like when you spoke about it earlier, that they just have a clear view also when they're sitting where they need to be at the final parts of the stage. And I mean, I think it was clear to everyone that they went, but then being able to do that, I mean, obviously the sprinters, trains were trying to get established, but there are other GC riders, you know, who are still in the mix of it. They weren't there, and I think they were probably, they learned a little bit of a lesson today about how this at least this early part of the Giro will be.
Brian, I just used a lot of adjectives to describe Pogacar's move, sort of rhapsodized about his move there, but was it foolhardy as well? Was it could he do without moves like that, particularly given this grand project that he has of winning two Grand Tours and the sort of economy that that's going to require?
Well, I mean, the first part of the stage was very slow, fairly easy, you know, and I just think it's you know, a lot of what he does is obviously based on his incredible engine and his like talent unlike anything we've seen before. But I think he also races a lot on intuition, and I really also think that sometimes he can't help it. You know, had he tried to go, you know, halfway through the stage, had he been in the first group when it broke, that would have been foolhardy. But, you know, doing an effort like that with 2.7 kilometers, I mean, he could have won the stage on that move. So I think, you know, fair play to him for trying. And, you know, the next couple of stages, unless, you know, we're wrong about how they will unfold, I think why the hell not? I think I kind of also feel like he lost out on the stage when that way he sees it in Torino. So maybe he just has an idea that he's going to leave this first week with at least a couple of them.
Yeah. He did pink jersey wearer's press conference after the stage as well. He was in sort of mischievous form, I would say. He was asked whether all of this was costing him too much, and he said, well, it's cost me nothing. I haven't spent a single euro on the Giro d'Italia so far. I've been on a paid holiday for 6 days. He was also asked whether he wanted to win every stage, and he said no comment. I don't know whether that was supposed to be a sort of a humorous, mirthful question, and I don't know whether it's supposed to be a humorous, mirthful answer, but that's what he said anyway. And Brian, we shouldn't neglect to mention and to talk about Tim Merlier's stage victory. Tim Merlier has a bit of a habit of winning the first sprint in major tours. That's been a bit of a pattern in his major tour career so far. The Rocket of Vertigem, he was asked in his press conference about his nickname, the magician. I didn't, and the Belgian journalist that I spoke to seems to be unaware that he had a nickname, that the magician of wherever it is, Vertigem, and he seemed slightly bemused by this as well. I don't know whether it's got something to do with wizards and Merlin. He seems slightly confused by this. I don't know whether it's got something to do with wizards and Merlin. Anyway, the more common nickname for him is the Rocket of Vertigem.
I mean, it'd be quite subtle if it was the Wizard of Merlin. I kind of like that, but any team needs a big win at any given time of the season. But it's also, I think, it's quite a relief for his team that they also win significant races when Remco Evenepoel is not here. You know, the Giro wasn't what they'd hoped for last year, and they've sort of come here with certainly hopes of at least one stage win, and getting that one in the books already is, I think, that causes for a bit of sigh of a relief. You know, Patrick Lefebvre is not here already, but when he does show up, the weather's going to need to be a little bit warmer before we see him in his white hat. But he's going to be in a good mood, I think, because now that stage win is marked off.
Talking of rockets and things that move very quickly, move very fast, Stacey Snyder's cups moved very fast. They went on sale yesterday. Well, yesterday was Sunday, wasn't it? Losing track of the days already. They went on sale yesterday and they were sold out immediately, as is also a bit of a tradition of cycling podcast at the Giro d'Italia. Another thing that is an institution, a tradition, as far as we're concerned, as far as the Giro is concerned, as far as Giro Vagando is concerned, well, he's a gentleman who I mentioned a minute ago, the Gazzetta dello Sport. He is a gentleman who works for La Gazzetta dello Sport. I think you know who I am talking about.
Ciro, come va?
Fine, thank you. Today I want to speak only about cycling. So no beaches, no sea, no, nothing. Tactics, race.
Let's do that. Let's talk about tactics. There seems to be, Ciro, there's a bigger and bigger gulf. I don't know, do you know the word gulf? Division between the way the world watches professional cycling on, for example, people who are watching on television and who comment on the internet, on social media, and people here at the race. I'll just say that. Yesterday on social media, on the internet, there was a lot of criticism for Ineos and their tactics. What do you think? Or did you hear anything when you were talking to riders and team managers last night?
Well, I mean, in my opinion, I listened to the explanation by, for example, Dario Cioni about the tactic of Ineos. If I'm not wrong, he said that they wanted to honor the jersey, and so for this reason they did the race more or less in front of the group, more or less last the final climb. I really not agree with him. I mean, I'm also I have a little bit of criticism about these tactics, because in my opinion it's something that the way to honor the jersey, you could honor the jersey in several ways, but tactically speaking it's better to leave the weight of the race on UAE, because they have the stronger rider. So in my opinion it's better. Yes, what do you think?
I'm not convinced, Ciro. I'm not convinced. I don't think it would. Look, what no one can see at home, and we don't know either, is how much the speed is varying throughout the course of the day. And it could be that actually the Ineos were changing their speed to suit their riders quite a lot yesterday. People just see the jerseys on the front and they think, okay, Ineos are riding hard. Might have been that at certain points of the race, when their captains, who are the most important people for them, didn't want them to ride hard, they were slowing down and they were taking it easy. It's like, you know, you put your team on the front, it's like having a remote control, rather than having to adapt to what other people want to do.
It's also true, yes. It's a good vision. I also noticed that yesterday, always about tactics, yesterday Geraint Thomas...
Nervous. We're 2 minutes 50 into this little intervento and we're still talking about cycling. This has never happened before.
Never happened, but I would like to know if our listeners, they prefer me in this version or in my usual version. Maybe we could launch a poll between our listeners. Why not?
But go on, Chair. I interrupt.
Exactly. No, for example, Geraint Thomas yesterday took the bonification, 2 seconds. Obviously, Mr. G is here for the overall. But sometimes I'm also a little bit skeptical. I mean, from a point of view, I think, well, but what does it mean? 2 seconds? I mean, it's nothing. So it's really important to do this kind of sprint. But always thinking at the last edition of the Giro, he lost the Giro only for 14 seconds in Rome. So maybe he was right.
I think that's enough cycling, isn't it?
Yes, exactly.
Ciro, quickly, a big day for La Gazzetta today. Well, because the big boss, your boss,
yes.
Mr. Cairo, the race goes through his home village. Is it a village?
Tell
us.
Abbazia Masio, exactly, a village, will be the first intermediate sprint for the point jersey. And yes, obviously, because his origins are from Piemonte, and this Giro has 3 stages and also the start of the 4th stage from Piemonte, so it's quite big.
Last thing, what do you think of this gentleman here who's dressed in full Mercatone Uno pink jersey? He's got the Pantani goatee beard as well. And what are your thoughts?
We know how important has been Marco Pantani for Italian cycling. Yeah. But as a matter of fact, this is my personal opinion, not only about Pantani, but always when we talk about past in cycling. In my opinion,
it's too much.
in my opinion, in cycling, it is a general tendency, especially in Italy, is too much. Much better to speak about present and about future. My pleasure, and I hope to hear again from you soon.
Ciro, wanting to talk about cycling of all things here at the Giro d'Italia. I don't know what you made of that, Brian. Ciro talking about this. Well, this criticism, a lot of criticism for Ineos yesterday. We didn't discuss it in the podcast yesterday. We discussed it in the car. On the way to our
I think
hotel.
We discussed the discussion in the car.
Yeah, we did. It all got a bit meta. We discussed the discussion in the car, and then when we had dinner, we discussed the discussion about the discussion, I think. And what was our conclusion? What was your conclusion?
My conclusion is I don't understand the criticism. And it's not just by the, you know, given the fact that I believe that they know what they're doing, Ineos, and I think that one of the reasons why the outrage, if that was an outrage, but when also Ciro refers to what Dario Cioni, the DS, says that they wanted to honor the pink jersey, and that's great. I'll give him the benefit, Cioni, by saying that he probably took for granted that people knew that they were taking charge of the stage for several reasons. One of them, and I think the least important one, was honoring the pink jersey. The most important one was keeping the race under control. Geraint Thomas is, as we saw today and as we saw yesterday, is clearly riding really well. He has other competitors here than Tadej Pogacar, and when you're sitting in that position in the race, you dictate what's happening in terms of the tempo. You're sitting in the right position, you know everything that's going on. You're there if there's any bonus seconds to be picked up here or there. And you have a clear view of how the stage unfolds. I think that's really obvious. I think there's a fantasy game going on in some faraway planet where people are watching the race via Twitter comments, that you sort of think that they should just like pull the brakes and then let UAE, you know, start working from kilometer zero. Cycling doesn't work like that. Sports directors don't think like that for all the right reasons. And this Giro is very, very long. And if, you know, yesterday, as we saw, you know, there were only two riders who really was sort of on the level just below Tadej Pogacar, and one of them was Geraint Thomas. So they need to put in all kinds of positioning and damage to his other competitors for being the next competitor to Tadej Pogacar. And if they think they can wear out Tadej Pogacar and UAE by not pulling on that stage, I think that would be completely naive as well.
I just think that whenever you are making the assumption that someone is stupid and doing things that are idiotic, usually you're overlooking a logic that they're following. I think generally you have to sort of respect other people's, respect the fact that there is always a logic there. And there's also a lot of experience, and there's also a lot of information.
Exactly. And especially one of those elements of information is how the team is faring and how they feel themselves. And I would probably trust the judgment of, you know, even if I, you know, I allow myself to be critical. Obviously, that's my job here. I actually allow myself to trust the instinct and the judgment of Geraint Thomas next to a blogger that hasn't neither written or been at a bike race.
I do think it's faster to just dismiss everything on the internet.
No, I'm not dismissing.
Everything on social media is
I'm just soberly saying that I probably have more faith in Geraint Thomas's judgment of how the race should unfold, given what he knows about himself and the team, than to an outsider.
That said, there probably are some dogmas that still exist in the kind of tactical kind of textbook in professional cycling that a lot of teams, a lot of things are doing on a day-to-day basis that one day, whether it's soon or whether it's in the distant future, will be questioned and will be turned on their heads, and bike races in 5 or 10 years might start to look very different from what they look today. As a result of ideas coming in from the outside, for example, people watching on TV.
And teams also hire staff that don't have any experience in cycling. And so just to add to that, I'm not saying that mistakes aren't being made. I'm just saying that I'm not of the opinion that ones were made yesterday in that context.
Suggestions that the way Ineos rode yesterday was unwise. There was some criticism for another rider in particular yesterday, one individual rider, and it came from that rider himself. Ben O'Connor was very critical of Ben O'Connor. He said he was the dumbest rider in the peloton yesterday for trying to follow Tadej Pogacar. He suggested that he'd fallen out of the stupid tree and hit every branch on the way down, and he was a few peas short of a casserole.
Did he use those words?
No, he didn't.
That's phenomenal, though.
He didn't. But I, as we're about to hear, I suggested that he had suggested he was a burger short of a Happy Meal. Ben is the guest on today's very special edition of
La Renzando, a postcard from Italy with Larry Warbass.
Your comments yesterday got a lot of attention, you know, to the effect that you were sort of a hamburger short of a Happy Meal. You sort of suggested that the lights were all on the Christmas tree, but no one had switched them on. Words to that effect. On reflection, just tell us why you said that.
Because I think it was just unnecessary time loss. You know, I think it's all about accumulation, and Garrett, I think, is a good example of someone who kind of just doesn't lose time. He's consistent the whole way out through the race, and then he pounced at the end. He got some bonus seconds as well. It was a nice lesson learned to show why some guys can perform so well in Grand Tours.
I seem to remember having similar conversations with you last year at the Dauphiné about Vingegaard, and you being very aware that you shouldn't be trying to follow him. And did you, forget that yesterday, I suppose?
Yeah, my coach actually said to me at the start, know when to pull the plug when you go with Pog. I think I just felt so good that I held on far longer than was necessary. So, yeah, kind of cool to have tried. I've tried with Jonas a few times in his peak form, and I've tried now with Pog. But, yeah, you have to understand your physical capabilities and those limitations.
And what do you base that on in the moment? We'll bring in guest star Larry Warbass in a minute into his own segment. But we'll bring him in a second. But what do you base that on in the moment? Because obviously, you know, we're talking about 10 seconds in the race. You can't be completely focused on your head unit, looking at the watts. I don't know if you even pay any attention to that at all.
I don't look at that if you're by yourself. Otherwise, in a race situation, I don't look at it at all. So how do you know? How do you find that kind of like limit? I guess you have to try first. But I've managed to hold on before, after being dropped by the best guy in the race. But yeah, sadly that didn't happen yesterday. So yeah, in one way it's brave. One way people love it. I don't love it, but that's what I come away with in the end, just to be a little smarter and know where your race lies. And I think later in the race, in the third week, things normally level out and there's a bit more of an even playing field with the fatigue. And then I think the game is a bit more open again. But yeah, the first days, Pog is always at his best, to be honest. And he's shown that Grand Tour after Grand Tour, that first week is when he's normally at his most dominant.
Larry, what Ben's just said. Well, first of all, what did you think of Ben's scathing self-criticism yesterday? And also, what he's just said about Pogacar being his strongest at the start of a Grand Tour.
I think that's typical of Ben to be really hard on himself. He definitely holds himself to high standards. But I mean, that's also why he's successful as he is, you know? So in the end, I think it's cool that he tried. You know, it's like you don't know until you try. He lost a bit of time, but I think over the course of the 3 weeks, it's going to be fine. I'm sure he'll be right up there and it won't be an issue. But yeah, with Pogacar being, I mean, he's strongest in the first week and he's strongest in the last week, probably. Oh, no, yeah, but sure. I mean, he does, if you look at the Tour de France the last years, like, yeah, he shows the occasional faiblesse later
look
on.
Larry with his French.
You never know. I mean, Decathlon's ready to pounce when he shows that. So we'll see. Should be good.
Ben, you spent a lot of time with Larry in Sicily on Etna. We feel like we know Larry pretty well. What did you learn about Larry in that period on Etna?
We also spent time together in Torino as well. So it's been a long...
A dark side to Larry.
No, almost the American stereotype where it's optimistic and pretty happy almost all the time. And it's probably one of the good sides that keeps you going. You know, I nail myself with the hammer when I don't perform well or if I make a mistake. Whilst Larry kind of always has this ability to look on the brighter side. So, negatively, I don't really see any downside to spending time with him.
Hey Larry, how are you feeling?
Yeah, I feel pretty good, actually. So, felt good yesterday. Was up there with the guys, you know, up until, like, yeah, the last climb. Put him in good position. And, yeah, so it was actually a pretty good day for us. Yeah, I mean, Ben, he definitely gave it his best effort. And, you know, I don't think we could fault him for trying to follow Pogačar. That was pretty cool. So, you know, maybe he's disappointed. But in the end, I think it was a pretty good day out for us.
That was an enjoyable audience this morning with Ben O'Connor and Larry, Lucky Larry, the Motown maestro, who's, well, he'll be wanting his own chat show now. We're getting guests on La Ranzando.
They're like the Kelsey brothers of NFL.
Yeah, he'll want his own entourage and he'll have a very lengthy rider with, I don't know, things like puppies and pink from perfumed toilet paper on it. Ben O'Connor, 10th on general classification. Not a disaster for him. I mean, he's 1 minute 26 down. I think the time gaps by the end of this Giro d'Italia will be counted with a calendar, not with a stopwatch. So if Ben O'Connor can stick around at sort of 1 minute, 1.5 minutes, there or thereabouts for the next few days, then he'll be doing just fine. And Larry seems to be cruising along quite nicely. Of course, we'll be speaking to Larry most days, or certainly every other day at the Giro. So we'll be hearing plenty from him. Today's stage, as we sort of touched on earlier, as we mentioned earlier, on paper it didn't look like the most inspiring one. However, when I started thinking of ideas for this Giro d'Italia, things we could do, little detours we could do, and when the route was released, one idea that I did have and one thing that crossed my mind, and this was based on various things I'd been reading over the last few months, both in the international press and the Italian press, was that we were crossing an area today that's known as the sort of holy triangle of risotto and rice. And that is the sort of triangle formed by the towns of Pavia, Vercelli, and the other one is Novara, where we started today. So we were cutting right across a region or a zone, an area, where about 40% of the rice in Europe is produced. I've got some statistics here, Brian. 20,000 billion grains of rice, I think, a year are produced, approximately. That's not an exact figure, are produced on average every year in this area, the area that I've just mentioned. Most people nowadays are familiar with risotto and different types. Most people are probably familiar with three types that you commonly find in other countries. Arborio, Vialone Nano, and Carnaroli are the three main varieties that you'll find. However, there are about 450 varieties that are grown in this area. I said I'd been reading about risotto a lot this winter. I'm a bit of risotto is my, that's my specialist, that's my...
Your go-to primo.
Yeah, it is. It's definitely my go-to, especially with... It's always been my first date meal, Brian. Whenever I've had a, you know...
A date.
A female companion.
Right.
And I've cooked for them. Risotto.
Oh, wow.
I always go with risotto, first of all. But that's another story. That's a whole other podcast.
That's another kilometre zero.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe several. Anyway, Brian, I've been reading about it this winter because the rice-producing regions are in the front line of the sort of climate crisis and the debate, the talk about the climate crisis in Italy. 2 years ago, it was probably the worst year on record for the rice producers in this area. The worst drought in 200 years, in fact, hit the Po River, Italy's longest river. And these areas, well, where the rice is grown, it's kind of either side of the Po River. The Po, which the other day we were talking about the Monviso, which is the mountain that sort of looms over Turin. The Po rises on the Monviso, effectively, and it goes all the way to the Adriatic coast. So the drought in 2022, it wiped out a lot of rice producers. They had to call it a day. So bad were the economic consequences. And it has sort of sparked talk about the possible extinction of risotto rice. About 20 kilometers into today's stage, we knew we were going through some towns that are well served by rice producers, growers. And I thought it was a good opportunity to find out a little bit more about what's been going on with risotto. So we're going to hear a little vignette from the visit we did earlier today. And before that, we're going to hear from John Foote, author of Pedalare, professor of modern Italian studies at the University of Bristol, and, well, very often a sort of voice of reason on all things sort of culture, modern history for the Cycling Podcast.
most of the fields with machines, you need about two people. It used to be labour intensive. People would do it with their hands until the 50s. Women would do it. But now there's not enough water even for the most famous arborio rice. And it's a real crisis. And now Italy importing risotto rice. I mean, it's ridiculous, right? It shouldn't be happening. So this is a kind of, these are kind of very extreme examples of the very fast effect of climate change. It's a very powerful sign. And, you know, whether and Italy itself can do anything about it, I don't know. The Po is also the kind of symbolic. There's a great book by Tobias Jones called The Po, where he travels the length of it. And, you know, that's a real leitmotif of the crisis. It's either flooding or it's dry. And that's the kind of heart of all of that area, you know, that the area's lived off the Po for so long and it's dying in some ways.
Brian, quick stop, quick detour in a place called Stropiano? Stropiano? Well, we've got some problems with the new car and seatbelt. We're going in search of some rice.
Exactly.
That's all I'll say for now.
Yeah, I look forward to it, whatever it is.
Salve, buongiorno. Piacere, sono Daniel.
Piacere, Paola.
Grazie.
Volete fare un giro nell'azienda?
Ma molto volentieri, sì, sì.
Intanto che aspettiamo, sono già partiti?
Allora sono a chilometro 2-3, quindi arriveranno secondo me tra una mezz'oretta. Brian, kilometer 26 on today's route. We just met Paola Fiore, who's going to tell us about the rice that she grows, well, here in the middle of risotto country. And as I said, 26 kilometers from the start of today's stage, we're at the roadside with Paola, standing in on adjacent to her paddy field.
And Daniel, as you may or may not be able to hear on the pod, it's windy.
It is windy. And Brian, I said that last night I was going to go for the risotto hat trick. I'd had risotto the first night, second night. We didn't get risotto last night, but we're doing well. We've gone one better, as I said. We're standing in a paddy field and watching stage three of the Giro d'Italia. Paola.
Yes.
This is your paddy field. This is where you grow your rice. Quickly, we're going to get you to tell us about the rice in a minute. What's a good risotto for a cyclist? What's a good example of a risotto that a cyclist could eat?
Brown. Or rice brown or a risotto for a cyclist, I think with vegetables, with a little of zafferano.
Saffron?
Saffron, yes, of course. And little vegetable oils, not better.
Perfect. Well, Paola, in just a second, you're going to give us a little tour and tell us about how you grow the rice here. And well, what one can do with it.
Il consumatore per voler comprare la varietà Carnaroli, sì, ma che dentro il pacchetto ci sia scritto Carnaroli, che ci sia il Carnaroli, sotto il nome della varietà ci deve essere scritto classico. Allora, se c'è scritto Carnaroli classico, sì, arborio classico, dentro il pacchetto c'è proprio quella varietà lì, altrimenti ce n'è una che ha lo stesso rapporto lunghezza-larghezza del chicco.
That was a lovely hour we spent, well, watching the race with Paola Fiore of Riso in Fiore, you know, which is the family's company. Been in the family for 5 years. Five generations they've been growing rice. And but at the same time, quite alarming, wasn't it? Because she confirmed everything that I've read, really, about the dire predicament that some rice growers find themselves in. And she was talking particularly about Carnaroli rice, which is grown more, in fact, slightly more towards Milan. And that's, as I said before, one of the more common ones you will find in supermarkets throughout Europe. And that could really be an endangered species very soon, because that's one that needs a lot of water and it's not getting the water.
And the water, and sometimes it's getting the water, but it's getting at the very wrong time. That, you know, often when people talk about climate change, they, which is, you know, seems to be perfectly right, that the temperature is rising, but it's also that we get these extreme weather situations at the wrong time of year. You know, when I'm not cycling, podcasting or riding, I also work with farming in the wine industry, and it's the same problem, you know, that we have extreme weather at various times. And, you know, Paola herself said that the problem is that, if, for instance, now we'll notice that when we go further on into the Giro, there's still a lot of snow in the mountains, and that when that melts, it melts in at the wrong time of year for them, and there are no reservoirs to pick them up. So planning for the future and planning for how farming will look like because we can't reverse climate, you know, the climate change, unfortunately. Hopefully we can all participate in keeping it somewhat at bay. It is a real worry, and it's not just a worry for their private business, it's also a worry for feeding people. You know, the farming is not just about, you know, us walking around in fields and having a great time. This is food on the table for a lot more than the people who produce it.
There may come a time where people can't, on their first dates, they can't knock up a lovely risotto. I don't know, what's my favourite? It's probably a radicchio, Trevigiano, and gorgonzola. That's my absolute sort of, you know, showstopper.
Well, it must be because it's given you a...
I'm very happily in a relationship now. And I'm trying to remember. I'm pretty sure I cooked a risotto the first occasion that I did cook for.
The proof is in the pudding.
Brian, of course, a very famous, I think it's the biggest rice producer. Yeah, Riso Scotti, they sponsored a cycling team in the 90s. 1998, the team that featured Baldato, one of Pogacar's DS's here. Danilo Di Luca was a stagiaire there. Nicola Minali, Michele Bobrick. Ivan Basso was there. Did he turn pro there the following year? So, rice and cycling.
This Piano Rice. Do you remember the clip I sent to you from the tour where Maximilian Chandri is got beaten?
Yes. We were watching a clip the other day where Max Chandri was beaten in a sprint in, a, what was it, 1995 Tour de France. He was asked by Paul Sherwin, in fact. There wasn't the information available back then about how you pronounced every foreign name.
There wasn't a Rob Hatch at hand.
No. And Paul Sherwin asked Max Chandri what it felt like to be beaten by Bjarne Rice. And Max wasn't thrilled. Rice is an old saying, Brian, in this part of the world. It is born in the water and it dies in the wine.
On that note.
La tappa di domani e la cena di ieri. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's dinner.
We should be quick because I think we've gone on a long time, especially about rice. Last night's dinner, there was no rice, was there? But it was good.
Well, we kind of ended up in Party Central. You know, we were lodging at Agriturismo, which in this instance was a winery that had a few rooms, and what a lovely place it was. They produced their own type of Nebbiolo, famous in that area, and we could actually walk to the restaurant, walking downhill a cobble road, it felt like basically sliding down the Koppenberg. But we had a lovely dinner. It was a party night. There was music. We had the wine of the producer where we were staying. And
chocolate salami for dessert.
Yeah, very Piemontese in general. It was I think we are lucky just to be here, but we've been generally quite lucky with where we've been eating so far.
Brian, tomorrow's stage.
Tomorrow's stage, yeah. So it's from Acquiterme to... Acquiterme is still, I believe, in Piemonte, and we're heading down to Ligurian coast, and we'll be ending up in Andorra after 190 kilometers of racing. There was a category climb...
Not the Andorra.
No.
Andorra.
Yeah, only...
One R.
Yeah, thank God. There's a category 3 climb halfway through the stage, the Colle del Melonio, but other than that, it's a fairly flat affair. However, quite close to the finish as we pass the town of La Guelia, which is also very famous for being, or traditionally was, one of the opening races in Italy. We will see the peloton or whomever's in the breakaway or any whatever attack there'll be go across the Capo Mele, which is one of the capi of our beloved race, Milano-San Remo.
How far
so
the finish?
The top is just the short of 3 kilometers to go.
Ooh, that looks... Pogcineration territory to me.
Yeah, or Alaphilippeication.
Yeah, interesting that Alaphilippe wasn't... I mean, they made the right decision because Tim Merlier won the stage. And judging by where Alaphilippe finished the stage, because he did lose some time, I think he was on Merlier duty, wasn't he?
Probably.
But tomorrow looks like a great opportunity for him. But Pog can't help himself, can he? So who knows what will happen tomorrow. Incidentally, there was a sort of similar finale in, was it stage 2 or 3 in 1998, which we did that podcast about, where they went over the Capi. And then Marco Pantani attacked behind Michele Bartoli. They didn't win, they didn't go to the finish. But, you know, maybe just the... just being on the percorso, on the roads that we know from Milan-San Remo, maybe that will inspire one or two riders tomorrow, and we'll see another crackerjack finale. We're going to Liguria tomorrow. Liguria, talking about food famous for its pesto. Brian, I'm going to give away one of my key research techniques for Giro d'Italia material now. I simply type in a foodstuff, like for Liguria, pesto, and the word for controversy, polemica, into Google, and inevitably, I get pages and pages of cracking stories, like this one, for example, from September last year. There's a politician down in Bologna, a left-wing politician called Mattia Santori, who went into some kind of government meeting in Bologna at the end of last year, brandishing two vials, or sort of two little bottles. One contained pesto, the other one contained cannabis, sort of pestoed cannabis, sort of mashed cannabis. And he said, look, he said, one of these is pesto, of a famous, you know, made by a famous company in Italy, and the other one is CBD. There's no difference between them. Both of them have pay their tax, or the manufacturer, both of them pay their tax, and they have employees, and they're risking their own money, and they should be made legal, and they're both made in Italy, or they're both a typical product of Italy. And he obviously is a big advocate for the legalization of marijuana in Italy. But yeah, and the region of Liguria reacted very angrily to this, and they said this fella Mattia Santori should eat more pesto and smoke less weed. But this was a big story in Italy at the end of last year. Hopefully we will be having some pesto tomorrow, and focaccia of course is famous as well. Brian, no, you will not be, well, I don't know, you can do what you want after hours in your room, but yeah, pesto, focaccia, and whatever else. That concludes tonight's episode. Brian, we have endeavoured to talk about cycling a little bit, as Ciro did earlier, as we did with Ciro. And we'll be back tomorrow. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Byrne.